Blog Talk Radio.
Metsville and baseball fans everywhere. My name is Michael Acolin, a.k.a. the Brooklyn Trolley Blogger. And on behalf of my partners Sam and Rich, I welcome you to a Metsian podcast. Now, Rich won't be with us. He's away on business. And Sam, there's a 50-50 chance you may make this evening's show, pop in and pop out. That said, let me bring on our guest with haste. He's a friend of the show. He's Gary Mack. You can catch him on Mets Musings. So, Gary, welcome to the show. Welcome back. And as I said to you before, happy belated New Year. I believe this is the first time you're speaking in 2020. Tell us what you're doing and where we can find it.
Well, thank you so much, Michael. It's always a pleasure to be on with you and Sam and Rich when they're available. I'm still doing my Mets Musings podcast, and that's available at MetsMusings.com or at Anchor.fm/Mets Musings. You can get it there. You can get it on Radio Public, Overcast, Apple Podcasts, Google Play. It's all over the place. You should be able to find it. And I also do a golf podcast for those golfers out there. There's got to be Mets fans that are golfers, right?
I'm
so,
sure.
You can listen to Talking Golf with Gary, and it's at TalkingGolfWithGary.com, and go check that out.
My friend, let's jump into, you know, the great topic of conversation this offseason, which was, you know, the deal that never was. Remember Let's Make a Deal on TV with Monty Hall? Remember all the goofiness and chicanery that used to go on that show? Well, I would say this is no different. You know, where do we begin? Back in December, when news broke out that Steve Cohen was going to purchase the team, Metsville was doing backflips. And here we are, the deal is dead, officially. We'll get into the details of that in a second, you know, but Gary, I'd be remiss if I didn't point out, and first, you know, I have an old saying, once is an occurrence, twice is a coincidence, and three times is a trend. And I say that because if we rewind the Mets clock back to the partnership between Doubleday and Wilpon, Nelson, you know, he never read the fine print. He got duped the hard way. And then, you know, there was the negotiations with Mr. Einhorn that also fell apart like wet toilet paper. And here we are with Steve Cohen. And, you know, this was one of the more ponderous negotiations that, you know, I've ever heard of. You know, Party A sells item to Party B. It should be that easy, but in this instance, it just wasn't. So, you know, your overall observations of, like I said, the deal that never was.
Well, you know, I was excited at first, but I could never understand the deal with, you know, somebody giving, I wish somebody would give me $2.6 billion and let me run everything still. It just didn't make sense, the whole five-year thing. And I've been thinking about it a lot lately with everything going on, and I really think that part of it was to get Jeffrey Wilpon to Social Security age. I mean, he's 57, 58. 5 years would have put him at 62. And then the rumor was he pushed for more years. So I'm really thinking that the guy never worked a day in his life other than for the Mets. And that's not to say he didn't work. I shouldn't say he never worked. But I think it was one of the reasons was to get him to Social Security. But the whole thing was just stupid, I thought, from the beginning. You buy a team, you buy a team. Forget about the 80%. Buy the 100%. And then SNY is not included. And what about the Cyclones and the Syracuse Mets? Are they included as well? It's a very confusing deal. It should have been all inclusive, all big, one big package, everything thrown in for whatever, $3.5 billion more money. Because don't forget, the 2.6 he was going to pay was for 80% of the team. So that's got to mean the team's got to be worth, you know, at least over $3 billion, then maybe $3.5 billion if you throw in SNY or something like that. It was just from the beginning, it just didn't smell right, the whole deal. And, you know, these guys are getting old. They want to get rid of the team, and I understand they want to save it for Jeffrey, but nobody wants the team. And it's not that it's because it's the Mets. None of Saul Katz, his children want to be involved in running a baseball team. And I don't think they want to work with Jeff Wilpon. The only one that wants anything out of this is Jeff Wilpon, and he's going to get a large amount of cash. He don't have to work till he gets Social Security. So I don't know. It's very confusing. Go get a minor league team then, because that's up in the air too. But go do that if you want to own a team, and leave the Mets alone. And I mean, now they're going to, you know, see what happens. I had a guy on the other day on Mets Musings, the guy that broke the story, the initial story about that the deal was in jeopardy. The guy from the New York Post, Thornton McEnery, and I had him on the show, and he kind of felt the deal was going to be dead. And lo and behold, it was dead the next day or so, within the next 24, 48 hours after he was on. But, you know, there's another player in all of this that, and there's a connection to something else with the Mets in the offseason, and that's Rob Manfred. And I am not a fan of Rob Manfred, those people that know me, and he's got a big part to play in this as well.
Nor am I. Not a fan of Manfred. I agree with you. I'm in lockstep with you on that one. You bring up a great point about Brooklyn and Syracuse, what happens to them. And as you say, you know, SNY is not part of this deal. So that just makes me ask, why would somebody step up and pony up all this money if the network isn't involved? Because that's the cash cow. You're asking somebody to take on, you're asking somebody to buy this team and take on roughly $50 million in annual debt because of Citi Field. You know, who's going to do that? Who's going to step up? I'm not saying that it's out of the realm of possibility, but I'm curious as to who would do that. Now, the latest, a recent report that came out today from Bloomberg says that the Mets will be put on sale and that there will be no preconditions with regards to organizational control. So, Gary, I got to ask you, if that's the case, that the team is now up for sale with no preconditions, and that, let's assume somebody buys, you know, I guess 80% power would be indeed vested in the purchaser. So what the hell was this all about with Steve Cohen and this five-year window?
I don't know.
I can only assume that they must have pissed off Cohen so badly that he wants nothing more to do with this. And here we are, the team's for sale with no preconditions.
And they threw him under the bus. I mean, Manfred threw him under the bus.
He
came out and literally cut his throat and said it wasn't the Wilpons, it was all Steve Cohen. Now we're finding out that, no, it was Jeff Wilpon wanting more years added on to his being in charge, and it really wasn't Cohen. And maybe if Jeff Wilpon came out and said, well, I want another 5 years, maybe Cohen said, well, then I want a lower price. That's possible. But why did Manfred – this is the second time during this offseason. Manfred has come out, though. He came out with this Houston Astros cheating scandal and named Carlos Beltran as the only player was named on that. Only
right.
player named. And he either forced them or he got the Mets, however, to jump to him – and fire Beltran because he didn't want Beltran around then. I believe that. I could be wrong, but this is my belief. I believe once this came out that he wanted to get revenge and he couldn't do it on Beltran because he was a player at the time. He said he wasn't going to suspend players, but now he had Beltran in his grasp because of the Mets hiring for the manager's job. So he got him fired. Now he owed the Mets. So what does he do? He throws Cohen under the bus and gives the Mets what they want in return. This whole thing stunk from high heaven. And now, you know, the big question is, I saw somebody on Facebook, right? Well, why can't Cohen come back then and say, well, here's, you know, $3 billion. Give me the whole thing now. But
yeah.
Now it's work. Now it's not because Manfred has poisoned him with the rest of the owners. And I'm sure Wilpon has been poisoning him with the rest of the owners, much like they did Einhorn. They were going behind Einhorn's back and poisoning the rest of the owners to vote against a certain part of the contract. You don't do that. Then just pull it out of the, you know, if you don't like it, then you negotiate it out of the contract. But they were going back to poison the owners against them. And that's why I would be concerned if I was Cohen. I would have been concerned about this five-year deal because they had 5 years still in charge to pull. What happens at the end of the fifth year after he's put money into this team that the owner said, we're not going to approve you? And then what? Is he get back the money? Is he out the money? What's the deal then? Because that's similar to what Einhorn wanted. Einhorn wanted his money back if he didn't get approved or something to that effect. You know, Manfred's got his fingerprints all over this. And I don't like that. And I don't know. I think they should be, you know, I've never said they should be forced to sell because you can't force somebody. But if they're that much in debt, and I would like to see the banks force them to sell, call in all the loans. Apparently, there was an article a few months ago that they were $350 million in that vicinity in debt, and their company was only worth $280 million. Call in those loans, and if they can't pay it, then they have to sell the team, and they have to take the highest bidder. That's what I would like to see. I don't know if that's going to happen. It's, you know, it could be done, but I doubt if that's what's going to happen. But, you know, there's a lot of chicanery going on here behind the scenes that we don't know about. But there are little bits and pieces that you see and you start putting the puzzle together. And, you know, I feel kind of bad for Saul Katz in a way because this he wants out. He's, what, I don't know, in his 70s, 80s or something. He wants out, and yet he's got a family. This is why it's no good to be in business with family because – you know, I was thinking, couldn't he just sell his shares or I guess they're in a partnership, so maybe he doesn't have his shares alone. I don't know. Or why aren't the Wilpons then, if they want to hold on to this team so much, why aren't they buying Saul Katz's shares out? I don't know. The whole thing is just very confusing.
And apparently that's, you know, part and parcel of dealing with the Wilpons. let's close that segment of the offseason out simply by saying, you know, the team is indeed up for sale still. No preconditions. Allen & Company, and this is according to the Bloomberg article, Allen & Company will begin new sales process for Mets immediately. So there we are. Gary, let's take this onto the field. Talk about Brody Van Wagenen's second offseason as general manager. And let's review some of his transactions and try to give this offseason a grade before we move on. As everyone knows, he transacted for pitchers Rick Porcello, Michael Wacha, Brad Brack is in the fold, and Dela Patantis has been brought on board to shore up the bullpen. Before we get into all those invitees and whatnot, you know, that was the extent of his off-season acquisitions, at least the notable ones. So, you know, with all the shenanigans that took place over the sale of the Mets or lack thereof, the managerial mess, you know, having to release Beltran or, you know, him agreeing to step away and replacing him with Luis Rojas, in conjunction with those player transactions, Gary, how would you rate the New York Mets' most recent offseason?
You know, it's a good question. I'm going to give him a B, and I think that not making a trade to bring in a big name and further depleting the farm system. And again, I'm not against it depending upon who the trade was. I was against it last year because I thought that was a bad trade and pointed out that it was. But, I mean, had they had to get rid of somebody to bring in, a Lindor or a Bryant or an Arenado, something like that, I could agree with that depending upon what extent it went to. But I'm going to give them a B for not making the Marte trade holding his ground there. And I do like the Porcello and the Waka signings and the Betances signings. It's a little bit, if you will, out of the Sandy Alderson playbook, getting some, I don't know if you call them retreads in this instance, but to a higher level signings than they used to do, getting people off the scrap heap. These guys were some proven good pitchers and ran into some problems either with teaching or with injuries or whatnot. So I kind of approve. I think he did an okay job. I think there's some other things behind the scenes that I've been reading about that seem like maybe he has an idea or he's got a different philosophy than in the past. They're talking about the Mets way that they have put together a system of how to teach and how to train these guys and stuff. So I'm interested in seeing more about that. That might be a good thing to have a consistency throughout the system, which is something that they never had. I'm a little disappointed with the firing of Edgardo Alfonso. I never saw that coming. Have no idea why they did that in the offseason. The guy wins a championship, and then they let him go. I mean, you know, I thought for sure they'd promote him, if anything, but just to let him go. And, of course, it wasn't all on Brody, the firing of Beltran or the letting go of Beltran or whatever you want to call it, and the musical chairs that took place after that. That couldn't have been – it wasn't all on Beltran. I mean, all on Brody, yet that's the ownership really should have stuck to their guns. But I think he did an okay job this winter. Not the best, but not the worst either.
Gary, I couldn't agree with you more. You read my mind. I give them a B. I contemplated a B minus, but you know the way they negotiated the manager's dilemma. You know, I'm inclined to give him a firm B. At this point, I'd like to bring in Sam Maxwell, our hit and run artist. What's up, partner?
What's going on, guys? I'm staring at the skyline as I go down the 14th Street promenade of Union City to Hoboken, Jersey City to Hoboken as well. And just hearing all this, I'm going to jump right in with, he said, you know, kind of Brody doing the Sandy Alderson philosophy. And without really repeating some stuff that you said, Gary, because I did agree with a lot of things that you said. Mm-hmm. But I wonder whether it's not the Sandy Alderson philosophy, it's the Jeff Wilpon philosophy. That seems to be really where, you know, last year you were trying to make your name, trying to make some big splashes. You had, you know, names, and it's kind of the reason why Carlos Beltran was hired, even though I would have liked to have seen him see what he could have done. But at the same time, you know, that's why maybe Sandy Alderson works so perfectly for the Jeff Wilpon philosophy, because he was used to doing it in Oakland, and certainly did not really have a strong opinion about giving out 7-year contracts to begin with, one way or the other. But, you know, you wonder, you know, somebody who has started a trend in management with the Knicks now going for a former agent as well. You know, you have to, I keep saying about Brody, like, there's no way that he doesn't want to give players money, like, and big players. I can't see him, you know, having come from being a player agent. I just think that, you know, I mean, you know, and maybe he does, maybe he certainly doesn't think there should be a 10-year deal for all of these guys, but, like, it just doesn't seem to fit, if you will, for somebody who used to negotiate this for the other side, that he wouldn't want to, that even though now he's negotiating on the other side, he still wouldn't want to keep some of that type of philosophy, that these guys are the bread and butter of the entertainment business that we're in. But, you know, it's Jeff Wilpon, I feel. And with everything that we've heard, you know, for a relatively quiet offseason, it's been pretty loud. And, you know, I know I just got here and you were asking specifically about Brody with Gary, but broad strokes, I will grade Brody's entire tenure so far as incomplete, because, you know, who knows where one begins and the other ends, if you understand. That's, you know, Jeff Wilpon, this guy really does see himself as this master executive. And, you know, we all make mistakes, but you hope that in life you can really truly look in the mirror and figure out whether you've been effective. Can Jeff Wilpon do that with the last 20 years of Mets baseball? They've had some successes here and there, but the number one thing I was worried about coming into 2015 was that this was just going to be yet another one of those little moments that they mess up, that they don't carry the momentum into something a little bit more sustained. Now, mind you, 2019, they kind of got back to winning ways and somewhat, but they needed to have yet another magical run to do so. And they missed the playoffs when they did that. So, you know, usually they have a longer string of losing seasons after their two in a row winning seasons. This bucking the trend just a tad. But so far, you know, you know, and he's probably, like, we're talking about Brody putting something together. That is partially an adjustment on Jeff Wilpon's part. But right now, you know, even the family has come to a crossroads that this isn't working out. Yet, Jeff and maybe Fred too, doesn't want to hear that they have to be gone so suddenly. So, I have to grade it incomplete, because you wonder, and obviously, you know, who knows whether the ownership would even keep Brody on board. But Brody right now is fighting for his life from an executive perspective. And this season, and his future after the Wilpons are gone, is a this is a very important moment in where Brody Van Wagenen goes in baseball as well as in his professional career.
Well, the players that he brought into the fold are going to have a lot to say about that. You know, they're ultimately going to decide whether he stays or go, whether it's this ownership or the next. Are you sticking around for a little bit, Sam? Oh, Sam. Sam?
We lost
Sam. I'm sure he'll be back.
Sam, point.
Hello.
Sam, how long are you with us, Sam?
Ah, that's what you asked. I apologize. I was in between some things. I'll be in and out most likely right now. I'm just grabbing my food that I was going to eat before the Oscars get going. But, yeah, I'm out here Lyft driving. Who knows if people are actually having parties like they used to. It seems like it's probably a little faded out. but I'm still going to try to take advantage from a lift perspective of the Oscar night.
All right, so let us continue taking our first few steps into the 2020 season. Spring training is upon us. Pitchers and catchers report tomorrow, Monday. Very happy about that. So let's start talking about pitchers and catchers. And in reverse order, I figure we start with catchers. Obviously, Wilson Ramos is the starter. No debate there. I would only say about him that he needs to be cut down to about 110 games, I would say. Otherwise, the big debate this spring is going to be over who his backup will be. Thomas Nito, Ali Sanchez are in the conversation. We've brought back the Mets brought back Rene Rivera, and David Rodriguez, who comes out of the Rays system, has been signed and is in camp, or will be in camp. Non-roster invitees, Patrick Mazika and Austin Bosart. So one of these guys is ultimately going to win the backup position. I was wondering if you guys had any thoughts as to who would win it, who the incumbent might be. I'll throw it out there. I want Rene Rivera. I like his hands. He has soft hands. And, you know, My primary point of emphasis behind the plate is a receiver. I need a receiver first and foremost. So if the Mets can manage Ramos's innings and his games and bring in Rivera as a late-inning replacement, you know, depending on the situation of any given game, that's the way I would head into the season. So what say you, Sam? I'll get you first, being that you might pop out of here. Oh, Sam, going once, going twice. Gary, the floor is yours.
Hello. You keep asking me to say stuff as I'm like positioning from outside to back into the car. The Bluetooth switches over. You know what I'm saying?
You want a second? Want a second to think about that?
No, I need you to repeat the last part.
All right. You know who the incumbent as to who the backup catcher might be this season.
Yeah, so I was totally ready. I was totally ready to agree with you. I completely agree. I don't think that we need to be Tomas Nitoing it, excuse me. Rene Rivera is a professional. He's got a little bit more pop than Nito, even if you're going to get like similar in terms of the average. It's just going to be about like 222, 230 most likely overall. But he seems to sometimes have an idea of big, you know, big moments, big home runs, and really helped, I think, with that drive of 2016 in an immense way. And the last time that Noah Syndergaard was really, you know, consistently an ace. And he's a receiver back there, like you said, Mike. He knows what he's doing back there, and it's not a detriment that he's 35 years old at this point because, you know, he's a backup catcher. He doesn't really receive all that much as the other one. So, yeah, I think he's a perfect complement to Wilson Ramos, and he'll probably end up being Noah Syndergaard's personal catcher, and I'm okay with that. You know, it's just we need to maximize everything, and I think we do that better with Rene Rivera at the major league level.
And I'll just repeat the names again. The non-roster invitees, catcher, are Patrick Mazika and Austin Bosart. And they did sign to a minor league contract and invited him to spring training, David Rodriguez, a Rays product. So, Gary, what say you about the backup?
Well, I do like Tomas Nito. I like Rene Rivera. Both of them are capable. I think Sam makes a good point. Rivera's a better power hitter, got a little bit more pop, and is a very good receiver. And Nito's a good receiver as well. The other guys, the point that I like about Nito and Rivera at this point is that both of them are familiar with the staff. So that's a big thing. And I just feel that maybe they should carry three catchers So you have that chance of putting in Nito, and you know you've got to have some young guys there, because if Rivera, I know 35, I know he's a backup catcher, but you know it's still a lot of wear and tear on the knees, going down, warming up pitches. You're still doing things like that. Ramos could get hurt. You want a little bit of youth in there, and I think that would be Nito because of his familiarity with everybody. Whereas Mesick has been playing a lot of first base the last couple of years, so I know they use him as a catcher, but he's been playing, I think, more first base than catching. Alex Sanchez, I don't know. I saw him in Brooklyn play and saw him play in other places, and I'm just not – they say he's got a great arm, and the only – you know, I've seen him throw the ball into center field, but it's not very accurate. Now, he could, of course, be working on that, and he could have gotten better. I haven't seen a lot of him last year, but I don't think his bat was that great. It's funny because now I'm reading about how he's a defensive catcher, and yet when they first signed him, I thought I read that he was an offensive catcher. So I don't know what it is. I don't know if he changed in the minor leagues. He can't hit anymore, but he can catch real good. I'm not sold on Ali Sanchez yet. The other guys, they just don't know the staff, and that's a big thing with this team and a team ready to contend or a team that has been contending. They don't know the staff, and you don't want to spend, the first couple of months trying to teach them and struggling through that when you got guys that can come right in as a Rivera and as a Nito. And I thought that was a good deal when they signed Rivera again because he is familiar with these guys. So I'll go with you. I like Rivera, but I'd like to see him if they're going to carry three guys. I think Nito should be the third.
Agreed. I'm agreed with Nito on number three. So, you know, with that, we resolved catcher for the moment. Let's talk pitching. And let's rewind back to the acquisitions, the offseason acquisitions. There's going to be a big fight for the fourth and fifth spots in the starting rotation. That's going to be amongst Steven Matz, Rick Porcello, Michael Wacha. How do you see this playing out, Gary?
Well, I think the real situation is going to be for number five, and I think Porcello is going to get a starting shot if he's, you know, shows anything in spring training. I think it's really between Wacha and Matz, and I don't know. You know, if Wacha can pitch like he did couple of years ago, it's going to be tough on Steven Matz. Now, of course, it's up to him to come up and pitch well. It's going to be an interesting thing, but it's nice. You know, we last year we had depth, but the pitching wasn't that strong in the depth area. If it was this year, we seem to have even more depth, but it's a better quality of depth, if that makes any sense. You know, now if a guy gets hurt, you got the chance. If Wacha makes the team, then you got Wacha that could come in if a starter get hurt. Or you can always shift Lugo, even though he was rated, the number six best relief pitcher by MLB Network or something last night. There is some depth there. And as I said, I did like the Porcello signing. And I like the Wacha signing. Hopefully they can get it back. But, you know, last year it really wasn't a starting pitching issue. It was the whole thing that cost us the wild card. I shouldn't say the whole thing that cost us the division. But what cost us the wild card was the bullpen. But we're talking starters now, I imagine. So I think it's going to be – Porcello's going to be the fourth starter, and I think – The battle is going to be between Matt and Wacha, and I would kind of put my money, I would think, on Matt's, because it would be nice to have to break up the rotation a little bit with a lefty.
We can bleed the bullpen into this somewhat with regards to Seth.
You know,
Lugo.
I want to also interject real quick and say that, Gary, we might as well say it costs us a division. That's We probably would have had the division had we had even like half of a good bullpen.
Yeah.
So Seth Lugo, he's demonstrated an inability to pitch effectively on back-to-back appearances. Should that, you know, put him into the in for the race of the fourth and fifth position, Sam? And you know, again, well, how do you see this fourth and fifth starter playing out? And is pressure on Steven Matz to say get over the hump?
Well, I am on my way to pick somebody up now, so I will have to hop off real quick. But Matz, I would like, you know, he kind of worked well out of the bullpen last year. So at some point, so you kind of started experimenting with that, and I think that if it comes to that, then that's fine by me. But I think now Walker had a major league deal. Am I correct, guys?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, so he'll be there somewhat. You know, he'll make the team, but the question is where will he be? I think that Rick Porcello certainly ideally should be the fifth starter, and I definitely think that somehow, you know, you can get the most out of Michael Wacha. Somehow, I'm not sure if I have as much faith with that signing as you guys do. But I gotta get out of here now. I'll try to give you guys a call back soon, and I'll let you know, Mike, off the air as well.
Talk to you later, partner.
Okay.
Thanks, guys.
The Grapefruit League games will prove all this out. I'll throw it back to you, Gary. Seth Lugo, should he be in the mix for one of those rotation spots? Again, I'll say it, that he proved somewhat ineffective pitching on back-to-back performances. So I'll leave it at that.
It's a tough call. You know, he's done so well in the job that he's in, and I think he may be better for this team right now, the way it's constituted, to do what he was doing, to come in some games and pitch, you know, two innings or three innings perhaps, and maybe I'll come in and close a game if the bullpen's been heavily used. I think the I can't think of the guy's name, the guy with the Yankees had a couple of years ago, the lefty that was pitching all kinds of crazy. He pitched two innings and then an inning he was at Cleveland. Anyway, I think he's better in that kind of role to be used here, there, and everywhere in different situations because nothing seems to bother him. And I think that's it's better to keep him in that role, even if he needs a day off or, you know, he goes day to 2 days in a row and then the day off. I think there's enough depth if everybody's healthy. Again, it's if everybody's healthy. But, you know, if you can go through every team in the league and say, well, if everybody's healthy. So, yes, it's a lot of question marks with the Mets, but every team has got that same question mark. You know, I mean, what happens if the Braves lost Acuna and the other young guy that I can't think of his name? See what happens when you turn 66? Your mind fucks.
So, fill in the blank here. A successful season for Noah Syndergaard would entail what?
He's got to win 18. He's got to win 17, 18 games. He's got to dominate. He can't have a game where he doesn't have to be Cy Young, but he's got to be, you know, he can't give up six runs a game and then come back and throw a one-hitter. That's not going to cut it anymore. He's got to show consistency. He's got to show some domination in that consistency. You're not going to dominate every game, but you've got to show some DeGrom. You know, you got to show that even if you don't have your best stuff, you can gut your way through it instead of trying to overpower everybody. If you don't have the moving fastball, you got to, you know, hopefully have your breaking stuff, and you may have to use that. You got to show he's got to show he knows how to pitch, and he's got to be more consistent. Like I said, you know, he had games last year. He came in, he gave up, what, 6-7 runs a couple of games and like two innings, and then the next game he threw a one-hitter. You can't do that because that doesn't label you as a big-time star. He wants to be a big-time star. He's got to win 17 or 18 in my book, and analytics be damned in my estimation.
You know what? You mentioned Jacob DeGrom, so let's go there. In June, he turns 32 years old. So, again, fill in the blank. A successful season from Jacob DeGrom entails what?
Well, you know, just being DeGrom, I mean, you know, he wins 11, 12 games and won back-to-back Cy Young.
Isn't that something? Because, you know, compared to our childhoods, isn't that something, 10 and 11 games respectively?
Yeah. But he, you know, going back to our childhood, he's got the ERA that fits in with the greats from our childhood and the strikeouts and everything.
Yeah.
He's just got to have, you know, I think with a little bit more breaks and, you know, this could be a year where he wins 25 if everything goes well. You know, if he gets some hitting. How many games did he leave, Michael, last year with a lead? And the last 2 years with
so
leads
many.
In the bullpen blew. I mean, he could
so
have
many.
Won 16, 17, 18 the last couple of years instead of, 11 the year before. And I forget what he won last year. But, yeah, there's so many games that were lost because of that bullpen that, you know, he's just got to be what he can be. And the age doesn't bother me as much with him because not only he had the Tommy John surgery, but he's a pitcher. He knows how to pitch. You know, he's the closest thing we've seen to Tom Seaver in a long time from the Mets' point of view. I'm not comparing him to Tom Seaver by any stretch of the imagination, but I'm just, you know, I'm comparing him to the coolness, the calmness, the intelligence on the mound, the thinking through a game when you don't have your best stuff, the grinding out of a game. You know, we saw, both of us saw Seaver pitch a lot. And you saw him with great stuff, and you saw him with nothing, and yet he grind out a 2-1, 3-2 win or something like that, you know? DeGrom's got a lot of that in him. And he seems to get more bulldogish every year, and he seems to learn every year. And it's really been more fun watching that than anything else he does.
What a great pitcher. You know, just soak it in, folks. That's all I can say. You're listening to a Metsian podcast, and our guest this evening has been Gary Mack from Mets Musings. Let's get into some of these names, the invitees, non-roster, or minor league signings. And I don't know. You know, we're always looking for diamonds in the rough. Chasen Shreve comes to the Mets, you know, from St. Louis, and Steven Gonsalves. You know, he might help. He's got a power arm. He's up there with strikeouts and whatnot. He might help. They might break camp. I was looking around, a guy like Rob Whalen, I think he has potential. But then I look at some of these other names, you know, like Erasmo Ramirez. I don't think he can offer much. But there's other people that Mets fans can be familiar with or, you know, if you're into the minor leagues, should be familiar with, like David Peterson and Kevin Smith. So I wonder if there's any names on your mind, Gary, that, you know, might find themselves breaking camp with the Mets.
I think Gonsalves, if I'm saying that right, he's got a good chance, I think. Like you said, a power arm, and you can always do that. And, Ramirez, there's no harm in signing these guys. You give them an invite, and maybe you get lucky. Maybe you get something out of them. And, you know, sometimes they do this, too, to stock the minor leagues for depth if they have – a name down there that's got some major league experience and can call up in case of an emergency. And you never know what you're going to get, but I don't think there's going to be a lot of them, but I think a lot of these, or at least a few of them, were brought in for minor league depth. Maybe they'll trade them for a low level prospect if they show anything, but they, you know, can't make the team. They don't feel they're going to make the team, but they're showing a little bit of something. They can always move them in spring training. You know, guys move in spring training all the time. So I don't see a lot of guys making it. The first guy you mentioned, what was his name? Shear?
Jason Shreve.
Shreve, yeah. He could be a potential too. But I don't think it's going to go much beyond them, those two, Shreve and Gonsalves. I can't see anybody else. But, again, you never know. You throw it up against the wall and see what sticks.
Exactly. Maybe one of these guys can actually win one of the bullpen spots. Speaking of which, Jeremy Familia thinks it's a good idea to lose 30 pounds this offseason. Well, why didn't you think of that last year? How about that?
Well, you know, look, those of us that have a weight problem all our lives knows it's not easy. And, you know, you sometimes think you've had success at a certain amount of weight. Maybe if you lose it, you may lose some of that power or whatever. But now he's a little older, and he sees his mobility is a little bit better. He's feeling better. He's probably, you know, got more energy and stuff like that. So we'll see. Wouldn't it be nice to get him back, though, to what he was before?
It would be great if we can have flashes of old Jerry's back, you know. And that said, we need improvement from Edwin Diaz. He's been mentioned somewhat this offseason by Pedro Martinez. Think that'll have any effect on his performance?
Well, you know, I'll tell you what. I savaged him last year. I mean, I admit it. I beat that poor guy up left and right and up and down on the show. But I'm hoping he comes back. And I'll tell you, he showed me something this offseason by he worked with Phil Regan, who I think is terrific. He's been talking to Pedro Martinez. He's doing everything that he's supposed to do to improve that. You know, he's been working hard. I mean, he showed up at the Mets Fan Fest. He's been around the city and everything. That to me, I know it's something small, but it shows that he's not scared of the city, you know, that maybe New York isn't too big for him. Maybe it didn't kill his spirit. Maybe he's got that kind of fighting spirit that he's going to show us that he's better than what he was last year. And that's the first thing you have to ask, look for. If he's willing to do that. Now, whether it shows on the mound, we don't know, you know. I think his age, I don't think you lose your talent that fast. So who knows? If he can come back, and like I said, if Familia can come back, and if Betances is healthy, holy cow. Now look at the bullpen, 7, 8, and 9. That's a shutdown.
Well put. We got Sam back on the line. But very quickly, Gary, your quick thoughts on Jeremy Hefner, new Mets pitching coach.
You know, I liked Hefner. I liked him as a pitcher. I liked him. I liked the way he worked the game and stuff. I'm not crazy about the emphasis on analytics, but you know what? It's a fresh voice. It's a fresh look. Maybe it's a different perspective coming in. And, you know, I see Phil Regan's down at camp, so he's still talking to the guys and working with guys and helping. He's going to help out stay in the organization. So, I like Hefner. I like the choice. I like look, as much as I hate analytics, it's here to stay, even though I still believe it was analytics that brought about the whole cheating scandal, but that's another story for another day. Yeah, I like Heffner. I think it was a good choice, and I really like the entire coaching staff this year.
Okay, Sam, I asked Gary to fill in the blank. I want you to fill in the blank as well. A good season from Noah Syndergaard entails what? And then, you know, any thoughts on the bullpen? We said, you know, Jeremy's familiar thought it a good idea to lose 30 pounds this offseason. Why didn't he do that last year? And Gary brings up a good point that, you know, a trio, Familia, Diaz, and Betances, if all three of them can rebound, and we have an effective Justin Wilson, et cetera, this bullpen looks pretty good.
Noah Syndergaard has to be less home run prone, which, you know, and get back to dominating more often than not. That's basically what I think we need to see. And, you know, we kind of started seeing it from him at the tail end of last year. I think what Noah seems to be good at is adjusting early on once he has, like, a few hiccups in, like, the first inning, you know. And he may end up you know, that driving that ERA a little too high because he'll, you know, he'll dominate but then give up like three runs at the tail end of a, you know, like seventh inning of a dominating start. You know, and I think like he needs to figure that kind of side up. He just needs to dominate on a more consistent basis. With the bullpen, I think Gary brings a great point up about the fact that he's been all smiles. He's been out, you know, front and center, Edwin Diaz. And I was not in the camp that, like, there's no way he can survive here. Get rid of him. I mm-hmm. Like, how do you do that with, what is he, like 26 or so, something like that? You know, it's certainly a piece that you want to give more than one chance to bounce back. To see what he can do, because, I mean, he was electric until they, and I'm going to say it again, I've always brought it up, they fucking tooled with him during that rain game, and he was never the same since. And it's the snowball effect, and that's what happened to his season, because he was rather dominant for the first 2 months, and where you were just like, this might be my favorite pitcher overall on this team, well, other than Jacob DeGrom, but he was just like had so much bite and so much nastiness, and even in some of those games that he would unfortunately give up a home run in the with two outs, it's going to be interesting to see. I'm very curious to see what Diaz can do with Familia. You know, you didn't even realize how fat he was until you saw the before and after, and you're like, yo, you were fat, bro. So that might be something. Something to it there.
And why somebody didn't point that out, you know, that's worth asking, I guess. So, gentlemen, unless you have any outstanding issues regarding pitchers and catchers, we can move on into Mets and baseball history, if you don't mind. Going once, going twice. Let us delve into number 42. 10 people have worn number 42 for the New York Mets in history. So being that it's such a short list, I'll go through the names and then we'll pick them apart. But I'd be remiss if I didn't, you know, say that number 42 is more famously known for Mr. Jackie Robinson, and we'll get into that in a second. So the list of Mets who worn number 42, starting in 1964, Larry Elliott. Followed by Les Roar, Ron Taylor, world champion with the 69 Mets, Hank Webb, Chuck Taylor, Tom Hall, Ron Hodges, Roger McDowell, Butch Husky, and Mo Vaughn. A nice list for conversation that we will start with Mr. Gary.
Oh. Well, of course, Larry Elliott was in the early years. I think I don't even remember where he was. I don't know if he was a pitcher or an outfielder. I remember the name, but I can't really place him. Ron Taylor, terrific relief pitcher. 67-71. That was the on the winning team. Went over when he retired. Actually, became a doctor and was the team doctor for the Toronto Blue Jays for a number of years, I believe. The rest are inconsequential. The next two until you get to Ron Hodges, who wore it. They're just saying a year here, a year and a half. I thought he wore it longer than that. Ron Hodges was a backup.
I'm looking at 70. I'm looking at 73 to 84. 42 is the only number I remember him by.
Yeah, it's. I'm looking at 73 to 74. That could be a mistake. Well, anyway, a really good backup catcher, good solid guy, a timely hitter. Really, I was a big Ron Hodges fan, and oh yeah, yeah, they got it. I see it. I see it now. They got him twice on the list.
Ah.
Because they had Tom Hall, who wore it one day in 1975. Let's see, Roger McDowell, of course, terrific relief pitcher with the winning team in 86. Butch Husky was going to be the next best thing since sliced bread and had a nice career. He was a good ball player. He just was came up as a third baseman, really wasn't a third base. They moved him to the outfield. They tried him, you know, another one of those guys that didn't have really a position defensively and tried moving him all over the place and didn't work. And, of course, his first game, I believe, was a no-hitter, and he struck out like four times. Welcome to the big leagues. The last guy, what can you say? I don't even remember him playing in a game. Bo Vaughn. Did he actually play in a game? Where was I during that time?
He actually played
he did a moment where he hit that 505-foot shot off the scoreboard. So
yeah,
he does have, he, you know, and like that, you know, that's one of the fun things sometimes about the Mets is that they're like, you know, we have these little Linsanity moments, very, very isolated legendary moments. But other than that, Mo Vaughn is not a Mets legend, but he does have a legendary Met moment.
Okay.
Yeah, that's when Steve Phillips was busy acquiring people who suddenly forgot how to play baseball. Mo Vaughn, oh my goodness. But that was a prodigious home run that he hit.
He wasn't. I think that first year, though, he didn't really like Mo Vaughn wasn't like the worst first year signing because I mean, did somebody take a look at it? Because I'm driving. But that first year, he actually played in a lot of games, and I don't think the numbers were terrible.
I don't remember him. Yeah, he played in 139 games. I don't remember that.
Yeah, I remember.
Man, it must have been a rough
year. Because it's 2002.
Exactly. It was just one of those depressing seasons that, you know, we repress in the deep recesses of our minds,
yeah,
you know?
Must be. And I had season tickets then too, and I don't remember.
What can you say? Again, Steve Phillips. That's what comes to mind, and how he was running the club at that point. Let me see. I wonder, with regards to Butch Husky, how much Dallas Green either helped or hurt him as a player. I just wonder that.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you know, Ron Hodges, what a member of Bambi's Bandits. Remember that, Gary?
Yeah.
manager George Bamberger at the time. I believe it was 83, before they hired Davey Johnson. Ron Hodges, one of his collection of bench players. Who gave them that name? Was it Bamberger or was it the media, Bambi's Bandits?
I think it was the media.
Yeah.
Who knows?
But,
Frank Howard.
But Ron Hodges is one of those guys, you know, it's cool to grow up with, and at least I can speak for myself. And like you say, Ron Taylor, a great performer for the 69 Mets. I recap game by game the 69 season last year on my blog and just going through the box score each and every day, you know, it really was made clear to me how important he was to that team. So if we have nothing else.
He really was.
Say again, Gary?
I'm sorry. Hey, you guys were, I think there was a little bit overlapping. But what you were asking me about just number 42 in general?
No, I didn't, but that was my mistake. Sam, number 42, what say you?
Well, yeah, it's basically inconsequential until 1969. In fact, can you read those names again before Ron, what was it? Ron Taylor's 1969, correct?
Mo Vaughn, Butch Heskey, Roger McDowell, Ron Hodges, Tom Hall, Chuck Taylor, Hank Webb, Ron Taylor, Les Roar, and Larry Elliott.
Hank Webb's a great baseball name. Larry Elliott, you know, what can you say about Larry Elliott? No, I have nothing to say about that. That's a rhetorical question. I wonder, what can you say? But
well, you know what? You are the perfect person to segue us into Jackie Robinson. How's that?
Well, I will certainly get that done. I think, you know, it's interesting because there are there's a couple champions here. You got Roger McDowell right there. And, you know, you remember probably Roger McDowell's most remembered wearing number 42 upside down, or not really upside down, but looking like he was upside down. And Butch Husky, didn't he have a Mercury Met moment? Or something, where like there was like he ran into the wall, or no, that was I'm sorry. You know what? That was when he was with Seattle.
He was with Seattle.
I'm pretty sure there's a famous Butch Husky moment in one of those ugly futuristic uniforms, and
it might have been
I think like the he like, ran into the wall, like you know. Probably got concussed, but then they made fun of him with a chalk outline in the outfield. And I don't think he was playing for the Mets at the time, but I'm pretty sure it was in the he was with the Twins, and it was a Mariners game. But anyway,
Husky? I thought you were talking about Mo Vaughn. My mistake. I'll stay out of this.
No, but it's okay. It's okay, Mike. with Butch Husky and that, I forget exactly what team he was with, but that's what I remember the most about Butch Husky. I don't remember much or if anything at all, about him, as a Met. But the fact that you, brought up Dallas Green's name into the mix, you know, just makes me, reminds me that it was part of that era. It's really interesting. All these different players around the majors that wore number 42 and are remembered for being number 42. And, I'm sure they've had a Mariano Rivera day at Yankee Stadium, but, you know, technically it's already retired. So are they going to be retiring it specifically for him like they're going to be about Jeter? Just from a ceremonious standpoint, I don't think that's, you know, obviously I'm not a Yankee fan, so I pay attention to this on a daily basis, but that's curious too. It's interesting, like, of course, Major League Baseball wouldn't have thought about, you know, retiring it right away. And so, of course, people would still be taking number 42 and sometimes as an homage. But, you know, as the legacy grew and as years passed, you come to realize how important it was, even if you understood its importance at the time going through it. But it is so interesting now, you know, that, like, you have the Butch Huskies, you have the Mariano Riveras, and nobody else except for the one day will be wearing number 42 in Major League Baseball history. And, you know, there are some dissenters – And I understand where they're coming from regarding the Jackie Robinson Rotunda, but you can't deny the power that he has, and only the Mets could make Jackie Robinson's legacy come into question.
Yeah. I will only add that just a little public service announcement. Jackie Robinson Day, just to remind everyone, is April 15th. I think it was right of baseball in 1997 to retire his number. You know, I think at this point I'm going to stop venting my rage over Citi Field and what it is and what it isn't. I don't begrudge the Rotunda or featuring Jackie Robinson so prominently in it. If only they would have incorporated either A, more of the National League New York City history, or you know, totally embrace their Mets legacy. But in and of itself, it's a shrine to the Dodgers. So that's all
I think, if I may, I think they've made some efforts along that line to make it more of a Mets-oriented place. And I'd like to see something for maybe a Willie Mays or something, too. You know, let's really embrace New York National League.
But
that would be really
nice. The next thing, too, is that in the process, they have made it more Mets, but they've also they have completely ignored the Giants. Completely ignored the Giants.
Yeah, completely. And
that's why the seats are green. It's the polo grounds. It's the seats. It's the seats. Screw. Just get out of my baseball team. Ah.
I would like to see them incorporate more of their Giant DNA into Citi Field, so to say.
Maybe the next owner.
Yeah, we'll spring it all on him and see what they say. So unless you have any outstanding issues, gentlemen, I think it's time we get into our final word and let everyone go watch the Academy Awards. What do you say, Sam?
Sure. My final word is bring on baseball. Here we are. You know, there's an entire February of spring training ahead of us where, you know, you start getting a little bit of the taste. You just see, you know, them training on a daily, actual training on a daily basis. And then they start the intra-squad. You get a little bit of baseball, and the intra-squads are always just, you know, fun little scrimmage. Then we got real spring baseball. And if you got SNY or cable in general, then you're going to be able to tune in. And, you know, everybody needs spring training. The coaches need spring training. The players need spring training. The SNY booth needs spring training. I think the truck, sometimes you can tell that the truck needs spring training, and so do the announcers and the fans. The fans need spring training too. We can't just get right back into it, even if you've been, like Mike, paying attention to baseball this entire time with the Caribbean baseball going on. So you still need that the wheels to kind of, you know, slowly start turning at the beginning there. And I'm excited for that to come. It's always, and, you know, little public service announcement, today is my birthday. And, you know, it's always been one of the beautiful times. I think it was like 2011. On my birthday, Mr. Met was on the back cover, you know, doing the truck thing. It was a great photo too. And so one time on my birthday, like, the idea of spring training and my birthday merged on a you know, a for me a commemorative issue that I will one day frame, but right now it's just in storage. But I you know, whenever my birthday is, that means Mets baseball is soon thereafter. So bring on Mets baseball, and let's go Mets.
Mr. Gary Mack, thank you once again for appearing on the Metsian Podcast. We love having you on. You're an old friend of the show. We love to have you each and every time. So the floor is yours, sir, with your final word. And in addition to that, please give us another bio. Tell us what you're doing, where we can find it. And again, thank you for your time this evening, sir.
Well, thank you for having me. Happy birthday to Sam. I am having a birthday coming up as well, and I'm going to give everybody off that day. It's next
Thank
Monday.
You,
it's 17th, so everybody take the day off. in honor of my birthday. I won't say how old I am, but anyways, yeah, let's get to baseball. You know, we had enough of this tomfoolery all winter with all the connections. It's funny, you know, I forgot to mention that I'm also doing a general baseball show with a friend of mine from South Jersey. He's a Philly fan. His name's Rich Baxter. He's got a podcast called Phillies Talk, and we do a show called Baseball Talk Radio Show that's available at anchor.fm, Baseball Talk Radio Show. And we talk general baseball. We did it for a couple of years, then we quit for a while due to different things going on. Now we're back doing it again, having fun talking baseball. And we were discussing the other day how was your off season, and you know, he thought his was kind of long. I said mine was surprisingly short because there's been so much nonsense with the Mets, with the managerial merry-go-round, and then the sale, the no sale and whatnot. So I thought it flew by, but it's, you know, it's tiresome now. So now it's time to get talking about real baseball, talk about the story, especially as a podcaster. It's very difficult not to have something to talk about, you know? So now we'll have hopefully some stories. We'll have some of the other nonsense. I'm sure there'll be more stuff coming out about the sale, or the no sale, I should say. But, you know, we'll have some baseball stories, and that's, you know, can Cespedes stay healthy? Can the pitching staff stay healthy? And a lot of it's got to do with health. But do we have enough depth in the outfield? You know, why did they bring in Matt Adams? All of that stuff we can talk about, and that'll be great. And I want to thank you guys again. And as Mike said, I'm available at MetsMusings.com. It's the home of my Mets podcast, and we have guests on and talk about the different things. And I've had a lucky enough last year to have Ron Darling on, and we're trying to get him on again. And had some of the 69 Mets on last year, and it was really a great year last year. And this year we're going to try to do the same thing, get who we can get, have bloggers on, have podcasters on. We get Mike and Sam on, hopefully. And yeah, that's about it. And the golf show. So if anybody's interested, they can look for MetsMusings.com and TalkingGolfWithGary.com and anchor.fm/baseballtalkradioshow. And thanks for letting me plug all of that.
Absolutely. We love shameless plugs. You kidding me? That was episode 42 of the Betsy and Podcast, Pitchers and Catchers edition. Again, I'd like to thank Sam, and on behalf of our other partner, Rich, who's, what, I don't know, 35,000 feet in the air right about now, thank you for spending your time this evening on a Metsy and Podcast. Go enjoy the Oscars. I hope your favorite movie and actors win. How's that? Joy to all.
There you go.
Sam, take us home the only way you know how.
Only way I know how, while I stare at the skyline of Manhattan, let's go Mets. Let's go Mets. Take care, everybody. Thank you. Thanks, Gary.
Let's go.
Thanks, Mike.
Good night, everyone.
Good night.